Anne Rand and John K. Galbraith, Emblems for Today's Right and Left, was presented by Tim McIntosh on August 14, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. PDF notes accompany this talk.
So my plan for this talk is I'm going to give you a short biography of Ayn Rand, followed by a short biography of John Kenneth Galbraith, and then I'm going to, this may be stupid, but I'm going to try to give you just sort of a cursory look at what the American economy has done since World War II, mainly following different administrations, different presidential administrations. And then I'm going to look at the bigger critique or the bigger picture that Galbraith is painting of the new economy. And I'm actually going to try to, best I can, figure out if he's right or not. Even though the book is written 40 years ago, the new industrial state was written 40 years ago, I think a lot of the picture could actually still hold today. So I'm going to try my best to figure out if he's right or not. So let's start with Ayn Rand's biography. I'm going to start again with the story of her growing up in St. Petersburg, 12 years old. Russian Revolution happens. She can see it from the balcony of her parents' apartment. They leave. The Bolsheviks end up taking over her father's pharmacy, and eventually the communists take over her father's pharmacy in Crimea. This seems to be of immense importance to her, shaping her frame of mind. She entered the University of Petrograd and studied philosophy and history. And she would always view herself primarily as a philosopher, secondarily as a novelist, secondarily as an economist. She is a philosopher first and foremost in her mind. While she's at the University of Petrograd, I hope I'm saying that right, the communists begin to infiltrate the university, barring students from any sort of free inquiry. And during this time, one of her greatest pleasures was escaping to go see Western films and plays. She would sneak out. And she really loved the West because of the kind of movies and plays that they created. In 1925, at age 21, she obtained a travel visa from Russian officials, and she told them that she would return in a few months, but she knew that she was never going back to Russia for reasons we can probably all understand. After arriving in New York City, she set out for Hollywood, and she was determined to be a screenwriter. On her second day in Hollywood, Cecil B. DeMille saw her standing at the gate of her studio and offered her a ride into the set of his movie, the movie that he was producing at the time. This is her first job. She first worked as an extra and then as a scriptwriter. I find it ironic that the movie that Cecil B. DeMille was working on at the time, considering Rand's hostility to Christianity, was King of Kings, the big, huge Cecil B. DeMille movie. After working several hard luck jobs, she sold her first screenplay. It was called Red Pawn. Pawn, P-A-W-N, as in a chess pawn. The script featured the theme of the evils of dictatorship, particularly the one found in Soviet Russia, and she would never, on this theme, change her tune. She was always on point about the evils, generally of collectivism, specifically of Soviet Russia. 4 years after selling Red Pawn as a screenplay, she turned her hand to writing novels. But we should use the word novel very loosely. Don't think anything like Tolstoy. Don't think anything like Steinbeck. These are, and I don't think I'm being in any way unfair to her, propaganda. Pure and simple, her novels are black and white. She would publish 4 novels, We the Living, Anthem, The Fountainhead, and Atlas Shrugged. All of her novels follow a similar plot. Our world is locked in a titanic battle between the individualists and the collectivists. It's not just a battle of economics and politics, but it's a battle of mindsets. The individualists are the railroad builders, doctors, composers, architects, head of industries, those who plan, create, build, profit, and by their efforts help all of society. They are, as I mentioned before, heroic beings. They live unapologetically for themselves. They love who they want to, build what they want to, earn what they want to. They bow to no flag and no religion. If you know anything about Nietzsche, think Nietzsche's Superman clothed in a 3-piece suit as an industry titan. pitted against the individualists are the collectivists. They're self-loathing carpers who jealously resent the success of the individualists. Under the guise of government altruism, the collectivists have one abiding delight in life, and that is to tax individualists. This is joy, pure joy for them. Think Bela Lugosi's Dracula dressed as a government bureaucrat. That is a collectivist. If you think I'm unfairly representing Rand as a black and white thinker, I'll just read you part of a review from Whitaker Chambers' review of Atlas Shrugged in the New York Times. Whitaker Chambers would be very sympathetic with Ayn Rand at this point in his career. He wrote, "Miss Rand deals wholly in the blackest of blacks and the whitest of whites. Everything, everybody, is either all good or all bad." And Chambers points out that her book, to no surprise, contains none of the following: children, humor, or self-doubt. Despite the black and white nature of her novels, it's pretty hard to resist the moral indignation against the collectivist mindset. At least in our group, everyone just resonated with this. There's something very, very appealing about her sense of the individual taking responsibility for himself, for herself, and kind of a dismay at this kind of like growing sense of collectivism that's even now around. It's probably much more prevalent during Rand's time. Well, never mind. I take that last part back. I would think, given the circumstances that soon followed the publishing of Atlas Shrugged in 1957, that this picture of the uniqueness of individualism and the embodiment of it in the West would be very appealing. So the Bay of Pigs happens 4 years after Atlas Shrugged is published. The collectivists, the communists, park nuclear warheads off the coast of Florida and Cuba, and everyone is becoming very, very aware that this Cold War is not just an ideological war. It is a real, possible nuclear annihilation of the world sort of threat. So I would think that her writings would absolutely find a lot of favor in people who are experiencing that. Now, let's rewind to 1946, the year that Truman said, "This is the year that we lay the new foundation of the economic policy for the United States." That same year, John Kenneth Galbraith was speaking at the Economic Conference in Cleveland, and his opponent on the final panel of the conference was a man named Frank Knight of the University of Chicago, a staunch free marketeer. Knight and his companions during the panel hinted that Galbraith and his companions were communists in Keynesian clothing. Knight was adamant that America needed to stick with the tried and true principles of classical economics. Galbraith, of course, is going to argue against Knight. He's going to argue that the government needs to be more intrusive than Knight and his friends say so. But Galbraith did not want a planned economy or like European-style socialism. But he did believe that the free market, because of the growing influence of corporate power, needed regulation, and there's nobody big enough to regulate corporate power but the government. His vision of government regulation was not systemic. It was not, "We are going to plan whole industries." This sort of happens in England. The British government would take over, for example, the coal industry. And when Margaret Thatcher comes into power, she's got to take on not just the mindset, she's got to get government out of huge industries like the coal industry. And so when Margaret Thatcher goes toe-to-toe with the coal industries, this is sort of like her final hurrah. This is the great triumph of the kind of backlash against Keynesianism in Europe, or at least in England. But Galbraith's vision of government regulation is not systemic, but it's based on a case-by-case basis, an ad hoc basis. So here's a quote from Galbraith during the conference. "The notion that free market capitalist institutions are totally incompatible with security," and by security, what he means is Keynesian-type controls, "the notion that free market capitalist institutions are totally incompatible with security is, in my mind, one of the most unfortunate clichés of our time. We should not issue a blanket indictment of all measures that enhance security. Rather, we should support those steps toward greater security of income and employment that are consistent with free market decisions of entrepreneurs, and to indict those that are not. I am not," continuing the quote, "I am not so blindly optimistic as to suppose there is any easy formula, but I doubt that at the outset we should conclude that the task is impossible. at least so long as there is evidence from our recent history that the paths to freedom and security are at least partly convergent. I'm going to read that last part again. I doubt at the outset that we should conclude that the task is impossible, at least so long as there is evidence from our recent history that the paths to freedom and security are at least partly convergent. So I think what he's saying there is, look, we had a Keynesian economy during World War II. Worked out pretty good. And we still have maintained our freedom, so we shouldn't maybe necessarily completely back off from this idea. Does that make sense to everybody? After World War II, the United States economy did take a decided turn toward Keynesianism. Business leaders, many who feared a huge recession at the end of the war, jumped on the Keynesian train, although with fairly significant changes as compared to Europe. The Americanized version of Keynesianism isn't strictly Keynesianism. It's often called the neoclassical synthesis. One historian of ideas described the neoclassical synthesis this way. The older idea of national planning was amorphous as an intellectual concept and, to many people, deeply unsettling. But on the other hand, Keynesian techniques had an appeal that planning did not. They were grounded in theory, and they suggested certain limits of government intervention. Rather than focus on the performance of particular economic sectors, with the cumbersome idea of adjusting production in each industry, like the coal industry in England, post-war economic policymakers would use the broader tools of federal spending, interest rates, and on occasion tax policy to stimulate or restrict demand. I'm going to read the last sentence again because that was a long quote. Rather than focus on the performance of particular economic sectors with the cumbersome idea of adjusting production in each industry, post-war economic policymakers would use the broader tools of federal spending, interest rates, and on occasion tax policies to stimulate or restrict demand. Stimulate or restrict demand. If you ever heard in the 1980s, Reagan was a supply-side economist. So that's in distinction from this sort of, you're trying to control demand side of the economy. So he switches it. Now I'll talk a little bit more about that in 1 second. During the next 20 years, the Keynesian model dominated the American economic policy. Even Republican presidents were believers. Nixon took us off the gold/silver standard and famously proclaimed in 1971, "We are all Keynesians now." Then he left his aides to draft replies to angry conservative supporters that because he had introduced a full employment budget and approved deficit spending to reduce unemployment. Things grew more Keynesian in the 1970s, maybe culminating in the Carter presidency, though the Carter presidency wasn't exactly emblematic of a Keynesian-style economic leadership. It was just really seemingly ad hoc. By the time Reagan assumed office, in 1980, the federal tax code had collected nearly 20% of America's gross domestic product. The tide was ripe for an economic sea change, and we had an economic sea change. If we had let the Commanding Heights video run another 30 minutes, we would have gotten into this big change during the Reagan and Thatcher years. Reagan and Thatcher stripped taxes, controls, and regulations on industry. As you would expect, John Kenneth Galbraith was an outcast during the 80s. He was persona non grata. It got so bad that Robert Nisbet accused John Galbraith of actually suffering clinical psychopathology similar to that witnessed in premillennial religious groups. He ripped Galbraith because he wasn't on board with the Reagan plan. Reagan introduced the Economic Recovery Tax Act, which aimed to slash tax brackets by 30% over the next 3 years. The idea behind Reaganomics is that you cut money to corporations and the wealthy, they in turn become more productive, produce more goods and services, and this trickles down and is a benefit to the larger economy. Trickle-down economics, it's often called also. Reagan slashed in his first tax bill nearly 300 domestic programs. That is absolutely amazing. 300 domestic programs. However, deficit spending increased pretty dramatically and military spending increased pretty dramatically. But it was, in historical parlance, a return to Hayek and Adam Smith's principles. After Reagan, with the occasional blip, neoclassical economics continued to carry the day. Clinton initially raised taxes on the wealthy during his first year in office, but 2 years afterwards, I remember this because I was in Washington, D.C. when it happened, 2 years afterwards, the Republican Revolution of 1994 came. All these young Republican congressmen and senators came in, and it was a sharp, sharp rebuke from the populace to Clinton. Clinton changes his tune and becomes, one of my friends, a Democrat, said, he became the best Republican president since Reagan. He was great. George W. Bush continued the Clinton/congressional Republicans' efforts to balance the budget. The budget got balanced in 2001-2002. After 9/11, spending seems to increase dramatically. Bush is often accused, you're a great Democratic president with regards to your spending habits. By all indications, President Obama is now leaning back toward the Keynesian trend in deficit spending, injecting the economy with goods, services, and capital, and increasing government controls. In short, Galbraith rises in popularity when the corporate/market world grows corrupt, and then, on the other hand, Friedman will grow more popular when the government grows more corrupt. I think we'll probably see that for a long time. But I'm going to turn now back to Galbraith's central theses in The New Industrial Society. So the book was written 20 years after the end of World War II. It sold like hotcakes. It sold so many copies. It was especially amazing considering there were a lot of things going on in the late 1960s. Americans weren't primarily concerned, it seems to me, about economics. But Galbraith's book sold extremely well because he seemed to be giving this comprehensive view of what the new world economy was looking like. I'm going to lay out 5 theses that are in the book. Now, a lot of these did not show up in your reading. The reading you got was maybe 1/4 of the book. So I'm going to expand it, tell you what the broad 5 theses of the book are, and then I'm going to actually try to take these theses one at a time and see, is he painting an accurate picture here? Thesis number 1. The giant corporation is the characteristic organization of modern capitalism. Keep in mind what Charlie said yesterday, that corporations are not part of Adam Smith's system. Not only did they not really exist that much, but he didn't want them to exist for several different reasons, but at least one of the reasons is it separates ownership from management. This is a big problem in Smith's view. Next thesis. Shareholders, who are the owners of corporations, have little power over corporate decision-making. Instead, the technostructure shapes corporations' culture, goals, and behavior. So this is probably the part that you're most familiar with from your reading, this look at the technostructure. Next thesis, the members of the technostructure who don't own significant blocks of stock tend to dislike economic uncertainty and thus are less inclined to risk. Again, this is different from Smith. Smith would say that your movers and shakers are willing to take risks because there's huge profit to be made out there. And Galbraith is saying this has changed. This has changed dramatically. Corporations don't like to take risks, or the techno structure doesn't like to take risks. Number 4, a national ideology for consumption and affluence distracts citizens from the poverty in our midst. Advertising underscores, emphasizes a national ideology for consumption and affluence, convincing citizens of what they want. Not just advertising for what they already want, but making them want things. Second, the modern economy convinces corporations operate according to the free market, or at least that's what corporations are trying to get leaders to believe. The key resource in the modern economy is not massive industry, but mobilized and organized intelligence. Central to this idea is the educational and scientific estate of scholars, teachers, researchers at university and nonprofits. All right, so I'm going to go through these one at a time. My critique comes from 2 places. A guy named Robert Solow, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, S-O-L-O-W, he's an economist at MIT. When the New Industrial Society came out, he writes a review of it, and he's extremely critical of Galbraith. I think Solow is much more of a free marketeer. So he's very critical of Galbraith, Galbraith knew that he had to respond immediately to what Solow would say because he felt like Solow was wrong. And so there's a publication still around today. Irving Kristol used to run it called The Public Interest. I don't know if you guys ever look at The Public Interest. I think it's a quarterly academic magazine. Solow responds in The Public Interest. The Public Interest tells Galbraith that Solow is responding. Galbraith says, it's so important for me to respond that I will pay you to hold up the printing so I can actually respond so that people can read both his critique and my response to his critique. So this is the showdown, big showdown. Okay, so with regards to number one, the giant corporation is the characteristic organization of modern capitalism, so says Galbraith. Solow says that Galbraith is exaggerating the importance of corporations, and he says that only 55% of the gross national product was even in the non-financial sector. And not nearly all of that is generated by the giant corporation. What's more, says Solow, non-manufacturing sectors of the economy are going to become more important in the future. Thus, the role of the large corporation is probably going to be more limited in the future. This is 1967 that Solow is saying this. Now let's look at modern numbers. Galbraith is absolutely right with this charge if the modern number, given modern numbers. Solow missed this one entirely. So here are just a few statistics. All of these are from the U.S. Census Bureau website business report, business statistics. Manufacturing. Today, half of 1% of all manufacturing firms employ more than 50% of all manufacturing workers. Got that? So look at 100% today. 100% of all the manufacturing that happens in the United States, one half of the top 1%, this little group right here, they employ 50% of the people that are in manufacturing. Okay? Galbraith would say, of course, exactly. You've got these massive corporations that are hiring and they dominate the field. They got all the workers. That's just manufacturing. Retailing. Top one half of 1% of companies employ more than 60% of all retail workers. So manufacturing, it was this top one half 1%, got 50% of all manufacturing jobs. It's even bigger in retailing. It's 60% of all retail jobs are found in this top one half 1%. Walmart, which was a tiny retailer in 1967, is today the world's largest corporation, visited by 100 million customers each week. And it has 1.5 million employees. It's $256 billion in sales equal, get this, 2.4% of the United States gross domestic product. It's incredible. I'm not trying to pick on Walmart. Everybody likes to pick on Walmart, but you got to look at the numbers. One more sector of the economy, information technology and healthcare. Since 1967, information technology and healthcare, the information technology and healthcare industries have exploded since 1967. And today, one half of 1% of companies employs more than 70% of all information technology and healthcare workers. So it seems pretty clear that Galbraith's charge that the giant corporation is the characteristic organization of modern capitalism, not individual sellers. It seems like this charge is kind of cut and dry. Galbraith is right on that. Second one, shareholders, owners of corporations, have little power over corporate decision making. Instead, the technostructure shapes corporations' culture, goals, and behavior. Robert Solow, the MIT economist in 67, is very critical of this thesis, arguing that market forces largely constrain corporations from behaving in a new and different way. And in retrospect, it looks like Solow is actually right. Since 1967, when Galbraith asserted this, the markets have grown much more competitive, at least in part in changes to the legal and regulatory environment. And you can probably think, you can look at Reagan and Thatcher and say, yeah, they made the system more competitive. And both these changes in the legal and regulatory standards have placed managers under greater pressure to answer to shareholders. Third thesis, the members of the technostructure who don't own significant blocks of stock tend to dislike economic uncertainty and thus are less inclined to risk. Okay, so I beat my head against a wall trying to figure out the answer to this question, and now I'm going to confess that I lacked both the time and, more obviously, the talent to figure this one out. This one, it is so complex. Solo and Galbraith disagree about this. Galbraith's biographer, who's himself an economist, himself is like, I don't really know. So I'm going to punt on this one, so forgive me. But I just want you to know, I was tempted to just cut it out, but it's a major aspect of what Galbraith is arguing for. I just don't know the answer to that one. Last two. A nationwide ideology for consumption and affluence distracts citizens from the poverty in our midst. It does this through advertising and by convincing leaders that corporations are operating by the free market. And number five, the key resource isn't massive industry. The key resource in today's economy isn't massive industry, but mobilized and organized intelligence. Robert Solow, in criticizing Galbraith in 67 in The Public Interest, looks at these two things and he says, man, Galbraith isn't even doing economics now. This is ad hoc. This is going to be so, how do you test this? How do you test a national ideology for consumption? How can you put this on a grid and test this? And how can you test this also? So he just dismisses it. Here's what he says. He was first critical of Galbraith because Galbraith wrote some of this book in Stade, his chalet in Stade. And he was like, yeah, it's really easy for you to talk about the affluence and consumption in American society from your chalet, Germany. You're going to go skiing in the afternoon. Yeah, you talk about affluence all you want to. Please, preach to us. He was real critical of Galbraith personally. But his main critique on this is he says, look, Galbraith isn't being an economist here. He's being a moralist. Shame on him. Shame on him for being a moralist. Morals and economics don't have anything to do with each other. You get what I'm saying? Here's Galbraith's biographer commenting on this debate between Solow and Galbraith. The Galbraith and Solow exchange may seem like an artifact of its time, and the issues preoccupying them seem very dated. But that is to misunderstand its significance, because it was a battle. This is a key thing. It was a battle for the controlling metaphors of economics and for a dominant rhetorical form that defines what is and isn't properly acceptable as economics. Solow asks his readers to think of economics as strictly a scientific project. It's a matter of doing the numbers. This project consists of hypotheses that can be formulated as mathematical statements to be tested by mathematical techniques. And since Galbraith didn't provide such tests, he shouldn't be regarded with these two points to be considered an economist. He's a moralist. Galbraith would, I think, in a candid moment say, absolutely right. He wouldn't say, I'm failing to be a good economist. I mean, he thinks the numbers actually hold up. But he's saying, absolutely right, I am a moralist. I think this situation is in some way wrong. And I think that should be part of the economic conversation. That's the end of my presentation. I'll just kind of close giving my take on Rand and Galbraith. I don't know if you guys felt this way. It seemed like a lot of people in our group felt this way. There's something about Rand, when you read it as an individual, it's so compelling. Taking responsibility for your own life. Nobody can answer for you but you. And there's something even in the biblical account of what we're supposed to do, it resonates with that. She flies off the deep end. There's no kind of God in her picture, and she gets really wacky if you read her books. She gets really nutty at some points. But there's something still, there's a kernel about like this sense of individual responsibility that seems to be ebbing away from, that was ebbing away from people during her time, seems to be ebbing away from us now, that's really compelling. But I'm also, even though she and Galbraith would absolutely, I don't know if they could sit in the same room together for a very long time, I'm really sympathetic with Galbraith's critique. I mean, he seems to have this pretty accurate picture that the world we're living in now is not Adam Smith's world. It's a corporate world. It's a corporate world, and the government is also extremely involved in a way that it was not during Adam Smith's time. And I'm also appreciative of Galbraith's sense that, like, there's something really fundamentally morally wrong with this desire to constantly consume, 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 that seems to be the habit of the American economy at present. However, Galbraith's solutions may end up being worse than the problem that he's trying to address. I mean, he ends up becoming very, very, more and more socialist. He loathed Nixon. He thought that Nixon was absolutely brilliant and absolutely pernicious. And after Nixon's administration, Galbraith drifts more and more and more toward just strict socialism. And Hayek would say, probably, of course he did. Exactly right. That's the way it always goes. So that's kind of my take on Galbraith and Rand. Any thoughts, questions? And also, I am not, if I got any of the kind of ebb and flow of the historical movement of economics like during the last 45 years, I am open to amendment. If there are things that you think I left out or really needed to be tweaked, please tell me.
So I've often puzzled over the large corporate support of planned economy. Mm-hmm. And my puzzle has always been, my gosh, it's been the free economy that enabled you, large corporation, to grow. And now you're here and you seem to be supporting these planned. This is a two-part question. So I'm wondering some insight into that. But the next question is your very first point, large corporations will dominate the landscape.
Yeah.
Would Solo or in hindsight, would somebody argue that, well, that really wasn't, that was more an impact of government regulation that empowered these large corporations to grow and oppress the small? And therefore, if it was, in perhaps Solo's point of view, if we really had maintained a more capitalist, free-thinking economy, then the large corporations would not have been so dominant. It was the planned economy that really brought this about. Anyway, just so if some...
So let me take the second part first. Maybe you can remind me of the first part in a second. I think that maybe Solo would argue that more than Galbraith, that government interference actually helped create larger corporations. But I think he's going to also have to grant Galbraith's point that the reason that large corporations exist is because the type of widgets that we're producing now are so extremely complex. I mean, think about like an iPhone. Think about all of the different bits of information, all these different pieces that have to come together to create an iPhone. No person, no single person can do that. The only way that you can do it is if you get a mass of money preparing the way for research and development, and also a mass of just intellectual horsepower that's got to come from all these different places. I think that Solow would grant that Galbraith is right on that account, but he may say, yeah, but government policies have actually engendered or consolidated corporations. I think he'd probably say both, whereas Galbraith would probably just say, no, it's just the nature of the industry more so.
The first question was these corporations that grew up and were empowered by a free market economy come to a certain size.
Yeah.
And so many of our corporate leaders are so supportive of planned economies that would in fact have disabled them to exist if they were starting new, but they want it now.
Because they're in existence and the other guys aren't.
Well, yeah, I guess these are kind of the arguments, but any more, you know, insight into that seeming inconsistency to me, but it just seems to be a reality.
I'm willing to take a pot shot at it, but anybody else who feels like they've got more information on this than me is welcome to weigh in. An example that somebody in our group brought up was, this is your argument, look at a particular industry like the medical industry. The amount of regulations that it takes the U.S. government to keep track of that industry, it's mountains and mountains and mountains of paper. And that in itself is such an obstacle to a new business getting into the medical industry that it's just almost not worth it. And keeping that as this sort of like state of affairs for corporations, maybe in their best interest. They don't want more competitors. They want to just be able to do business as it is. I don't know if this is a fair analogy, and David, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but starting Gutenberg College, mountains and mountains and mountains of paperwork that you have to file just to start a new college. University of Oregon, not that we're a big threat to the University of Oregon, but they don't want that. They're fine with things being as they are. The mountains of paperwork, it's fine being as it is.
Any business likes freedom of competition when they're first starting up, but once they emerge, they want as much of a monopoly as they can get. It is interesting, Hitler had a command economy, and one of the things that made Hitler successful was early on he made an adjustment in his policies and spoke to some leaders of industry in Germany and won them over, because in his command economy they were going to have a privileged position, and he received a lot of funding from major industries as a result of that. This is one from my father. He lived on a small dairy growing up, and while they were in business, they started using milking machines. The larger dairies use milking machines. And milking machines require a lot more sanitation. And so the large dairies put pressure on the legislature to require that all dairies carry out certain hygienic practices, including pasteurization. Pasteurization had never been necessary on my father's dairy because sanitation measures were relatively simple. They milked by hand, and they'd never had trouble with bacteria. But with the milking machines, that becomes more of a problem, so pasteurization becomes necessary. So the law was passed that all dairies had to pasteurize. That increased the costs of production in my father's dairy considerably. So businesses like that, large businesses like to impose regulations that restrict the competition from the smaller upstarts. That's always the case.
I picked up a hint of concern for persons in Galbraith that I didn't pick up in reading Keynes. It seems in Keynes they were more of a factor in the equation, and Galbraith seemed to have a little more concern about the well-being of the persons that have to live in this economy. And comparing him to Ayn Rand, her hope in the well-being of a person is in the person, right? Give them a little freedom and access to power, they'll take care of themselves. What was Galbraith's, what was his level of concern in that, and what was his hope for the individual in his view of the system?
I think his concern is mainly in making the system equitable. His scope is big picture. Rand's is about individuals. And so he's less concerned with individuals. He doesn't think that they don't matter, but he's not out to reform the way that people think, where it seems like Rand is. As evidence of what Galbraith thought his best efforts would be spent on, he worked in the Lyndon Johnson administration, and he wrote speeches for the launching of the Great Society. This is the direction it ought to go. And there's a question about whether or not that's actually doing good for the government to get involved in individuals' lives like that, but that's the way he saw his project going. He would say, though, that Keynes is just as concerned with like the well-being of individuals as he is.
Just a quick question. Adam Smith, classical. Now we're talking about neoclassical. Just a quick sketch as to the neo part of the neoclassical.
It's trying to take Adam Smith's view and incorporate them and kind of tweak them with a couple of really prominent economists. One of them is a guy named David Ricardo. And so it's an attempt to sort of update the model, to keep the general principles the same, but to update the model with new findings. And I think in this particular part, the late 40s, early 50s and 60s, there's also a tendency toward viewing it as a science, viewing economics as a science, trying to understand the principles at stake and the flow of money and investment and industry.
Can you help me understand? This is something I've never understood, so forgive me if it seems really simple, but you said Reagan, so he released regulations so that the free market hopefully could prosper, and yet he used deficit spending for what, military? I'm trying to find a connection. It seems like there seems to be a tendency where governments that have more intervention regulate the market, but then governments that deregulate also build up the military. And those are seen as
those don't quite fit in your mind?
Yeah, I'm trying to see how the Federal Reserve, like one, the military is seen as an arm of the government.
Yep.
And so, yeah, could you help me?
So let's take Reagan. Reagan is going to cut taxes for the wealthy. So all that tax revenue that's going to be coming into government coffers is now gone. It doubled because the cycle is going now. No, that's very, very helpful. Government, increased government or military spending aspect of it, oh, man, I'm going to walk out on a don't quite understand it myself. I think part of the motivation, aside from just the bare facts of we need to defend our country, are it gets more money into the system also. You're putting more money into the economy. You're spending more on military. I mean, anybody else feel like they've got a good...
But it's not seen as anything... It's not seen as socialized. It's not criticized in the same way as when Keynesians pushed that red button of the Federal Reserve. I don't see how they're different, and so maybe you can help me see how they're different.
They're the same in that the government is spending. Help me out, Peter.
Well, with regard to military spending, it seems to me as though there's public perception where at the end of Carter's term, there are this handful of Americans who have been held captive in Iran for well over a year by that time because of the perceived weakness of America on the international scene, and because Carter had dramatically, and this is what people say, had dramatically decreased military spending. So I'm not sure that Reagan's buildup of the military had as much to do with the conscious, I'm going to build up the economy.
It more had to do with public perception of military power.
That the military had been eviscerated is too strong a word. The military
was weak.
Downgraded, and that we were perceived internationally, perhaps rightly, as being very weak. And Reagan,
and Jeannie, so you're kind of saying, like, in a dollars and cents, the money is either being injected into the military by the government, or it's being injected into the industry, just kind of like maybe by banks, or whatever. But dollars and cents wise, it's kind of coming from the same place. Is that kind of what you're?
Maybe I don't really see it. I'm just wondering. It seems like there's a polarization happening where this type of thinking always brings about mm-hmm. this problem, and it's solved that way. And I don't see it so clearly as. Because I don't understand the deficit spending and the military part of it. I don't really know.
Let's go to Charlie, and we'll come back to Dave.
Can I respond? I agree with Peter, but I'd like to give sort of a similar answer from a longer historical perspective. And the answer is, if you're a free market economist like Adam Smith and you're interested in markets, it's really important that those trade routes are open. So historically, free market economists have always been interested in military because, one, you like peace, so you want to be strong so nobody's going to attack you because you like peace because that's when you make all your money. You don't, well, historically, you'd rather have peace than war because at least you've got conditions you can deal with. But two, if you're going to trade, if you're a country going to build trade routes and build markets, you have to be able to defend them. I mean, on a very small scale, look at the effect of piracy now. I mean, piracy has the effect of making trade problematic. So historically, I would say, there's been kind of a link between free market economics and military spending.
Yeah.
So that's a little counterintuitive, but...
And protecting trade routes is different than imperialism.
Yes. Right.
I mean, that's what some people will leap to is... large military imperialist, we're going to take over the whole world. Protecting trade routes is very different. And I would suggest with regard to the question, I don't think in the case of Reagan, I don't have the sense that there was a connection in his mind between we have to build up the military in order to stimulate the economy. I don't think that is necessarily a philosophical connection.
At the beginning of this talk,
you mentioned the Bay of Pigs. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that the wartime economy is this exception to the rules, mm-hmm. that even free market economists agree that in a wartime you've got to have planning, and it's just the only thing to do. You've got to survive. And my sense is that that your observation is accurate. Yeah, he was stimulating the economy just like a planned economist would deal, but he was doing it because he felt we were in wartime. He was defending the country so it looked the same, but the real question is, once we're out of wartime, would he still have thrown all that money into the military?
Yeah.
And I think what Peter says, maybe not. Or a free market economist would not have.
I think you meant the Cuban Missile Crisis, right?
I was thinking also with regard to different kinds of government actions that can be taken to, quote-unquote, interfere with the economy. It could be argued that military spending is a legitimate, as opposed to illegitimate in a free market, is a legitimate method of government economic action. If the military is a function of government, it is legitimate for them to spend money on it and even to spend what some might call excessively on it for various reasons, like the point Mr. Eastman made, that there was the perception that it was a war, and it could be perceived that that is legitimate, and may not have even been the economy, stimulating the economy may not have even been a factor, like you were saying, in Reagan's mind. As far as the deficit spending, I'm not entirely sure how that works, but it seems to me that the attempt made by that is to inject money into the system, that money the government doesn't have at the time, obviously. It requires that they print more money, does it not? Am I correct in that?
It depends on the historical circumstances. If there's money in the vault, they don't have to print more money.
Okay.
But if there's no money in the vault, they'd have to print more money.
Well, yeah, the attempt, it would seem, with deficit spending is that they're trying to boost the system temporarily because it's floundering or it's just stagnating.
That socialization, the fact they're spending because in a deficit. Yeah, it kind of depends on what our working definition of Keynesian is. If it's Keynes himself, that's one definition. You only insert money into the system or take money out of the system, as examples, during times of crisis. Really cold economy, really hot economy. But popularly, we're using Keynesianism in a different way, that it's like much more like socialism. So you've got to keep those definitions kind of distinct from each other.
I'll make the comment that everybody has done government intervention. It's not the case that anybody has not done government intervention. Reagan was the first, after World War II, to deficit spend. He cut taxes, but he raised the national debt. So I think it's kind of hard to label somebody with the various kinds of labels sometimes, and it's hard to figure out exactly the fine distinctions between, say, the neoclassicists and the neo-Keynesians and the monetarists and stuff like that. They're going to emphasize different methods, I think, of tinkering with the economy, either through deficit spending or changing the interest rates and changing the money supply and various other things like that. And they're going to emphasize different things in order to get the economy going. But I think everybody has come on board, as far as I can tell, in thinking that using these various government tools to modify and stimulate the economy is a good thing. And I will just make this one other comment with regard to military spending. Maybe I'm a little cynical here, but I think on both sides of the aisle, there is a sense in which we're going to emphasize spending on that particular segment of the society that is the one that helped us get elected. I think there's some of that that's involved in some of those decisions as well, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that's a little cynical.